Israel's right to defend itself. I added that how Israel did that mattered. I said that Hamas triggered the war when it massacred 1,200 innocent people and committed horrific acts of sexual violence. I listed by name the 5 American hostages still living and the 3 whose remains were still held by Hamas. Then I told the press that I had discussed with the Prime Minister the dire situation of innocent civilians in Gaza. I described the agonizing images of dead children and desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety, sometimes displaced for the 2nd, 3rd, or 4th time. I said, we cannot look away in the face of these tragedies. We cannot allow ourselves to become numb to the suffering, and I will not be silent. I described our discussions on the proposed ceasefire. To everyone who has been calling for a ceasefire, and to everyone who yearns for peace, I see you and I hear you. Let's get the deal done. July 26th, 102 days to the election. My days now started with a 15-minute briefing on how the campaign was landing in the news. But the big news of the day for my campaign wasn't news to me. Barack and Michelle Obama had decided the time was right to endorse me. They'd wanted to make a film of them calling me, and it was now up on social media. Netanyahu had flown down to Mar-a-Lago to see Trump. I learned that he was enraged by my remarks after our meeting. The briefing digressed to note that Trump had stopped wearing the bandage on his ear almost 2 weeks after the bullet had nicked it. Then there was a second briefing with my staffers Dean Lieberman and Ernie Apreza. Dean, a deputy national security advisor and skilled strategist, would update on international events, and Ernie, my press secretary, on domestic news. There was a note before the next item on my schedule. Hold for hearty breakfast. It's a reality of campaign life that a grown woman needs to be reminded to make time to eat. But what followed would be a day of almost back-to-back calls with little pause for refueling. There would be a DNC Finance Committee call with good news about the scale of donations, large and small, that were continuing to pour in. There was a call-in to the Faith Coalition hosted by my pastor, Reverend Brown, and we had to keep moving on the search for the person who would join my ticket. I had to find a vice presidential candidate, and I had to find one fast. From the day I got Joe's call, I had 16 days to do it, and now I had exactly 11 left. When Joe picked me, he'd taken over 9 weeks to thoroughly consider all his options. My deadline was August 6th. A day after the roll call that would formally nominate me. Ohio's ballot had an August 7th closing date, and they needed 2 names to print on the ballot. It was an excruciatingly tight time frame. My choice would impact not just the race, but also the shape of my administration. Being a vice presidential pick is an enormous gift, vaulting someone who might have local or state recognition onto the bigger, brighter national stage. But it can also mean taking a job that, as FDR's Vice President John Nance Garner so memorably said, may not be, quote, worth a bucket of warm piss. Jimmy Carter, having lived through the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the resignation of Nixon, knew that the vice president had to be ready to take over. He remade the role. His vice president, Walter Mondale, was the first to have an office in the West Wing. Ronald Reagan also understood that the vice president needed to be prepared, as did Bill Clinton. George W. Bush went further, ceding unprecedented power to Dick Cheney. But it remains true that the vice president's role will be as little or as much as the sitting president desires. That can be a hard pill to swallow. A couple of likely candidates, such as Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer and North Carolina's Roy Cooper, would preemptively withdraw from contention. We'd put a poll in the field to determine who among the other possibilities had name recognition, and of those, who had the kinds of positives and negatives that might help or hurt us. The results turned out to be useless. None of the names moved the needle either way. So that put the onus on what would turn up during vetting and what my personal chemistry with each candidate was like. I wanted someone who shared my vision and had the practical chops to implement our plans. We narrowed it down to 8 possible candidates and asked them to submit material such as financial disclosures, ads from previous political campaigns, and information about their personal lives that might not yet have found its way into the public record. My vetting team was led by Jen O'Malley Dillon, my campaign chief of staff, Sheila Nix, former Attorney General Eric Holder, and former White House counsel Dana Remes. There's a reason we had top cops and lawyers on the team. It's a prosecutorial process, as I had learned 4 years earlier when I sat across a table from the lawyer vetting me. The final stage after the investigation was an interrogation that lasted 9 hours. The attorney took every aspect of my past, especially the sensitive or difficult moments, and pressed me on them. Not because she didn't know the answers, but to see how I would handle the pressure. Did I get my back up? Could I pivot? Would my answers pass the smell test? She would periodically ask me if I wanted to take a break. I declined. We didn't get up from that table until she had fine-tooth combed my entire life. Biden had won the nomination because Congressman Jim Clyburn, leader of the Congressional Black Caucus, had thrown his support behind him. The black vote in the South Carolina primary, especially black women's vote, had thrust him to victory. The pressure was on him to pick a black woman running mate. The press knew I was on the short list, so they had our D.C. apartment building staked out. When Doug and I stepped out to go somewhere, they'd follow. Occasionally, I'd save them the trouble. I'd wander over to their van and say, "Hey, Doug and I are just going for coffee. Can I bring you something?" Getting to my interview with Joe was choreographed like a spy movie. Andy Vargas, my body person, drove me in our Audi to a strip mall, where I switched to an SUV and was instructed to duck as we approached a big house in Northern Virginia. I was led downstairs to the bottom level, to a room with closed drapes, where Jill and Joe would meet me. It was the height of COVID, so we were all wearing masks. Once you are chosen as vice presidential candidate, you barely have time to blink before your life becomes unrecognizable. Prior to getting the call from Joe to tell me he had picked me, I'd been visited by a friend, Carol, who has a remarkable garden. She wanted to give me a box of her late-season tomatoes. I was feeling stressed knowing that Joe was about to decide and that the world was watching. When I'm stressed, I like to cook. I greeted Carol in the lobby of my apartment building, both masked, and carried the box back upstairs, rolling up my sleeves to make a big batch of marinara for the freezer. I never made that sauce. Right after Joe's call at 2 p.m., cars started pulling up on the street outside, spilling out national campaign staffers with briefing books on every aspect of the campaign. I took the binders and gave each staffer a handful of ripe tomatoes in return. I hate wasting food. And now I was about to cause the same sudden swerve in someone else's life. Of the 8 names on the list for vetting, I might as well say that Pete Buttigieg was my first choice. Harvard grad, multilingual, Rhodes Scholar, business consultant, naval intelligence officer, twice elected Midwestern mayor, cabinet secretary, loving husband and father. He was well qualified in so many respects. I love Pete. I love working with Pete. He and his husband, Chasten, are friends. He is a sincere public servant with the rare talent of being able to frame liberal arguments in a way that makes it possible for conservatives to hear them. He knows the importance of taking our case to people who aren't usually exposed to it and is magnificent at sparring with opponents on Fox News. He would have been an ideal partner if I were a straight white man. But we were already asking a lot of America to accept a woman, a black woman, a black woman married to a Jewish man. Part of me wanted to say, screw it, let's just do it. But knowing what was at stake, it was too big of a risk. And I think Pete also knew that, to our mutual sadness. July 27th, 101 days to the election. We were on Air Force 2 en route to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Berkshires. This was an event that had been planned when enthusiasm for the campaign was flagging. Now it was through the roof. We'd had a target to raise $400,000 at this event, but that had shot up to over $1.5 million. Thank God, you guys, are top of the ticket. We weren't going to make payroll, a senior campaign finance official on the plane confided to Sheila. Until that moment, my team had no idea how bad things had been. The streets were lined with people waving handmade signs saying Madam President and singing the Woody Guthrie anthem, This Land Is Your Land. One sign, Lotus for POTUS, might have confounded anyone who didn't know Sanskrit. It came from a meme posted by a 53-year-old South Asian pediatrician right after Biden endorsed me. Quote, in Sanskrit, Kamala means lotus. In America, Kamala means POTUS. Pittsfield is a city of about 40,000, and despite its picturesque location in rolling wooded hills, it struggles with many of the issues of small-town rural America, such as a stubbornly high poverty rate and opioid addiction. But in summer, an influx of affluent arts lovers drawn to the rich cultural offerings at nearby Tanglewood masks those realities. The event at the historic Colonial Theater had been planned as a fundraiser for the Biden Victory Fund, but had been quickly rebranded as the Harris Victory Fund. Solidly blue Massachusetts wasn't used to seeing the presidential candidate this close to the election, when swing states generally get the lion's share of a candidate's time. And organizers half expected, now that I was top of the ticket, I'd send a surrogate. But I'd wanted to keep my commitment. The concert would feature A-list talents such as James Taylor and Yo-Yo Ma, both longtime Democratic supporters. The two Massachusetts senators were there, Elizabeth Warren, whom I'd come to know when fighting the big banks as California Attorney General, and Ed Markey, whose wife, Rear Admiral Susan Blumenthal, had helped Doug find his way in the foreign land of the Senate spouse. It was a warm, familiar crowd, slightly on the older side, dotted with longtime supporters and friends who'd driven west from Boston and Martha's Vineyard. As the campaign went on, the venues would get bigger and the crowds more diverse. Posses of young girls taking selfies, dads with their kids on their shoulders, tattooed teenagers ushering a grandma to a better vantage point. People of all ages, colors, wallet sizes, all standing shoulder to shoulder, being immensely kind to one another. I could feel the intensity of emotion. And my only thought, when glancing down at a tear-streaked face or grasping a hand on the rope line, there is so much at stake. I cannot fail these people. July 28th, 100 days to the election. That Sunday, I hunkered down at the vice president's residence to work on plans for the convention and to go over campaign strategy. Maya and Tony were staying with us. we worked on logistical plans for the large group of friends and family who would be attending the convention to support me. It's more than a notion. How much planning needs to go into that? Where they will stay, what they'll eat, who will look after the elderly ones, how to get them to and from the convention site, who will field the 101 questions they will have of me when I can't possibly take that call. National politics is one thing. Family politics can sometimes be just as gnarly. Maya, as always, took up the slack. The convention chair, Mignon Moore, started her political career with Jesse Jackson's presidential run in 1984 and worked for both Clintons and as an advisor on the Biden-Harris transition in 2020. She'd been tasked with planning a showcase for Joe, but because she is a subtle and strategic thinker who sees six moves ahead, she had formed a group called the What If Committee to prepare for all kinds of contingencies, such as what would happen if the Republicans deposited hundreds of migrants from the border, as they had been doing in Chicago right at the convention door. The possibility that Joe might drop out was also on the what-if list, but rated significantly below, ensuring that the media narrative that this convention could be a rerun of 1968 did not come to pass. Mignon's task benefited in the end by the Biden team's failure to engage with her to nail down Joe's convention theme. She was free to order up graphics for my theme, for the people, for our future. For the program, we had to figure out what to keep and what to throw out from what had been planned for Joe. Some of it was a given. There are large procedural segments. There will always be elected officials and union leaders and some celebrities. Anyone running for office lobbies hard for a speaking slot in prime time. In this case, they would need to be slotted in before Joe Biden's speech on night one, the vice presidential nominees on night two, and my acceptance speech on the final night. Each of us would have friends and family speaking as our lead-ins. We needed to tell my story in the production, and one aspect I wanted to highlight was my work as Attorney General. I think that the elected attorneys general are some of the most talented and dedicated officials in the country, and I wanted to throw a spotlight on them as well. The convention exists on two planes at the same time. It must work for the delegates in the hall, those committed community leaders from every state and every walk of life who live and breathe Democratic politics, and also for the television audience, who may have only just started to focus on the election as they deal with their daily responsibilities. I believe it is also in the party's interest to highlight our stars while we make it as entertaining as possible. When I became vice president, I had a secret project. I called it the Stars Project, that only my senior team knew about. We'd brainstorm about the younger talents in the party, and then, on Friday afternoons, I'd invite one or another to visit my office in the West Wing or the residence. As I'd offer a seat on the couch across from me, more than one nervously confessed, "I feel like I've been called into the principal's office." I would laugh and say, "No, I think you're very talented. What are you working on, and how can I help you?" Many of those on my list spoke at the convention. Lauren Underwood, Robert Garcia, Angela Alsobrooks, Latifah Simon, Maxwell Frost, Joe Neguse, Lena Hidalgo, Jasmine Crockett. Stephanie Cutter, a trusted advisor and veteran strategist, aided by Reggie Hudland, my best friend Chrisette's award-winning filmmaker husband, had started pulling together the short biographical video usual for the vice president. But now that I was top of the ticket, we had to scramble to find much more material. This video and my speech would be my introduction to the large numbers of people who had just tuned in to the campaign and really didn't know who I was. I would finally have control of the podium to reclaim my narrative and my identity. Early that evening, I got a call from Joe. For months, I'd been working on delicate negotiations to bring home former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan and Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich from their unjust imprisonment in Russia. While attending the Munich Security Conference in February, I'd used the opportunity to arrange private meetings with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Slovenian Prime Minister Robert Golob. Germany had in custody the inmate of most value to Vladimir Putin, the assassin Vadim Krasikov, who had killed a Chechen separatist in Berlin. Slovenia had two other Russians of interest to Putin. Poland and Norway each had one. It was a chess game with many states' interests in play. Chancellor Scholz is a serious, thoughtful man who weighed his options carefully. As with all the European heads of state, there was a heightened sense of the threat Putin represented. Eastern Europeans, especially, had experienced oppression under the kind of Greater Russia that Putin romanticized and yearned to recreate. There was also a melancholy sense that the United States was not the ally it had once been. Trump's first term had proven that our leadership of NATO, the world's greatest military alliance, was not constant and might be fleeting. Their knowledge of what happened in the 1930s is far greater than what they perceive ours to be. They can feel it in their blood and in their bones, and they legitimately fear we might abandon them. When I would say, "America is back," they would say, "For how long?" I always reassured them while silently praying that what I said would remain true. It was no small ask of Chancellor Scholz to release a murderer serving a life sentence, but he was motivated by the possibility of securing the release of Alexei Navalny, the leading opposition figure in Russia who had been saved from Russian poisoning by German doctors before bravely returning to Russia knowing he'd be imprisoned. A small team at the NSC and the Office of the Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs at the State Department had worked around the clock on the details of this complex negotiation, never forgetting for a minute that lives were at stake, as we tragically learned. Just before I was due to speak at the Munich Security Conference, we received dreadful news. Navalny was dead in his icy gulag, almost certainly murdered. I began my speech expressing deep sorrow for his death, saying it was another instance of Putin's brutality. Whatever story they tell, let us be clear, Russia is responsible. Navalny's widow, Yulia, had not been scheduled to speak at the conference, but she arrived, red-eyed and heartbroken, and took the podium after I spoke, giving a courageous call for resistance. The killing of Navalny made me even more motivated to achieve this prisoner swap, even though the chessboard had just been so violently overturned. Now, Joe was calling to say the pieces were finally moving into place. It looked like we'd soon be able to tell the families of Paul Whelan and Evan Gershkovich that their ordeal was finally over. July 29th, 99 days to the election. I had expected to debate J.D. Vance and had started to prep for that. Now we began to prepare to debate Donald Trump instead. The first session happened around the table in the vice president's residence. Later, we'd move to the basement at Howard University, fitted out to mimic the set on which the real debate would take place. I'd started my political career freshman year at Howard, running for a seat on the liberal arts student council against a smart, tough Jersey girl. I still consider it one of my hardest races. That day, we started with the broad strokes of debate strategy. For better or worse, a presidential debate is a television event, not a contest, on who knows the most about policy. The aim, my team stressed, was not to be the biggest wonk on the stage. The aim was to walk off leaving the voters comfortable that you have what it takes to be president. A lot of that is demeanor. You need to be confident, clear, and unrattled. The person who is winning, the team reminded me, is the person who is having the most fun. I got into the habit of drawing a little smiley face at the top of the blank pad that was placed on the podium so that I would keep that in mind. Then I drew a line bisecting the page. On one side would go a note about a Trump assertion. On the other, my response. Karen Dunn was the leader of my debate prep team. She is an experienced trial lawyer, a veteran of big, complex cases. If you need a wartime consigliere, she is the one. She is a taskmaster, very smart, and she really cared about me. Among the advice I got that first session, be on offense continually, especially on issues perceived to be vulnerabilities. He will try to rattle you and distract you. Don't fall for it. Be prepared to say, that's a lie. Remember, the economy is what keeps people up at night. With Rohini Kosoglu, my former Senate Chief of Staff and Domestic Policy Advisor, we started to create the debate book, a binder of issues that we gradually reduced to a stack of cards on which we developed and refined talking points, lines of attack, rebuttals to the kinds of lies Trump might spout. We had a card for every nuance of every subject, and once I memorized what was on that card, I'd draw a big loopy X across it. I am not a trained SEAL. I'm not going to memorize lines and spout them. I have to understand the logic and building blocks of every argument so I can present it clearly and defend it persuasively. We also addressed the painful matter of imagining what kinds of personal attacks Trump might mount against me. A man who had no floor, who could go infinitely low, get infinitely cruel. He'd disparaged the war hero, Senator John McCain, mocked a reporter's disability. The gutter was deep for this guy. I'd had quite a big team in the room to get the most diverse range of input I could on how answers would land. But for the part of the prep focusing on personal assaults, I narrowed the group to less than a handful. He might ask you if you've ever had an abortion, one advisor said. If he did, the response would be, that's none of your business and that's not what we're here for. Someone made a dark joke that if he got that personal, I should ask if he took Viagra. Another, had he ever paid for an abortion? In the end, he didn't go down that track. He probably knew a question like that would be exceedingly thin ice for him and would infuriate just about every woman in America. July 30th, 98 days to the election. There were 10,000 people at the rally in Atlanta. It was the first rally designed specifically for my candidacy, not as a supporting act to Joe. And I wanted to liven it up, broaden the cultural appeal, and bring more creativity and fun. Having Megan Thee Stallion opening for me and Quavo as a speaker was one way to do that. Both artists are committed activists. In 2022, Quavo, a talented hip-hop artist, witnessed his nephew and band member shot and killed. He became an ardent activist dedicated to ending gun violence. Megan is a generous philanthropist in her hometown of Houston and has done innovative work supporting education and financial literacy for women and girls nationally and abroad. She is also a red-hot rapper famous for provocative lyrics stressing body positivity. She embraced the nickname Stallion, given to her in her teens, for her tall, strong physique. I know my ladies in the crowd love their bodies, she told them. If you want to keep loving your bodies, you know who to vote for. She and her backup dancers performed in blue pantsuits, a witty nod to my style, even though theirs were of a cut and fit very different from the kind I wear. There had been a question about whether I should have any celebrities at my rallies. Would it seem too California, too Hollywood? I thought that the right surrogates could help expand the crowd and add excitement. There were questions about whether Megan was the right choice, as well as the usual online trolling. There were anxious remarks from supporters. You need to be more middle of the road. You're not projecting the right image as you come out of the box. I knew they were people who cared about me, but I also knew they were wrong. We needed to welcome everyone into this campaign, and that meant people who listened to music that ranged from Bruce Springsteen to Lil Wayne. By the time I got to the podium, the audience was on fire. In my speech, I talked about the threats to women's reproductive freedom. I berated Trump for sinking the bipartisan bill that would have helped with border security. I said, as my friend Quavo would say, he does not walk it like he talks it. And then I went after him for backing out of the debate. But he and his running mate sure seem to have a lot to say about me, I said. As the audience howled, I added, if you've got something to say, say it to my face. By the next day, national polls revealed we'd made up all the ground lost since Joe's debate. I was in a statistical dead heat with Trump. Later, I read the reporting on that rally with amusement and some chagrin. Many of the reporters now traveling with us hadn't covered rallies I'd been having as vice president. My college tour events had often been standing room only. Same with my rallies for reproductive rights. If they had covered those events, the enthusiasm in Atlanta might not have come as such a surprise. July 31st, 97 days to the election. In the summer of 2021, during her final trip to Washington as German chancellor, I hosted Angela Merkel for breakfast at the vice president's residence. I am a stickler for being on time. I feel it's a mark of respect. Everyone's time is valuable. But sometimes schedules go sideways and I fall short. That would not happen with the chancellor. Germans value punctuality, and I was determined we wouldn't come off as overly casual Americans. I asked to be passed a note when we had 5 minutes left so that I could wrap the discussion gracefully and end precisely on time. Contrary to how the press had covered the personality of this extraordinary leader, she was warm with a great sense of humor. I thought about the injustice of that portrayal as we spoke about many issues. The catastrophic flooding that had just ravaged Western Germany, my own experience with extreme weather events in California, and the imperative for multilateral action on climate policy. We discussed speeding up the global flow of COVID vaccines, drawing on her 15 years as the putative leader of Europe and her experiences dealing with four presidents. She spoke bluntly about her concerns over the vulnerabilities in U.S. global leadership post-9/11. She had opposed Bush's Mideast wars and been concerned by Trump's fundamental misunderstanding of the NATO alliance. When my staffer handed me the requested note and I started to wind up the discussion, she waved me off. Let me tell you a personal story, she said. As a woman and outsider who had risen to the highest level of her nation's government, she had particular advice she wished to share. She detailed how difficult her rise in politics had been. As a woman from East Germany at a time when her party was dominated by West German men, as it became clear how formidable she was, the attacks became personal, mean. They used to call me, she turned to her translator, whom she'd barely consulted during our meeting, and said a German word. It's a very ugly bird, the translator explained. They used to call me this ugly bird, she said. And at first, it hurt me deeply. She leaned forward. Don't you ever let them make you cry. On July 31st, I was aboard Air Force Two en route to Houston, where I would address Sigma Gamma Rho, another of the Divine Nine sororities. 4 days earlier, a supporter had offered to add a fundraiser ahead of that event. They thought at such short notice they might raise $1 million. They raised $2.5 million. I would spend that night in Houston, and the next day I would deliver a eulogy for the trailblazer Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, my sorority sister, a distinguished lawyer and judge, and a smart and strategic legislator whose district encompassed most of central Houston. She was a breast cancer survivor, but pancreatic cancer had taken her life. I was in my cabin polishing the eulogy when Kirsten, my media advisor, and Lorraine, my chief of staff, rapped on the door. "Trump just said you're not black." He was on stage at the annual meeting of the National Association of Black Journalists in Chicago, being interviewed by a three-woman panel. It wasn't a comfortable crowd for Trump. He got off to a rocky start, branding ABC reporter Rachel Scott nasty and rude after her first question about why black voters should trust him, in which she'd quoted his own racist language. Then she asked her second question. Republicans had said I was a DEI hire. Did he think I was only on the ticket because I was a black woman? He replied that he always thought I was Indian. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. It was the same old divisive playbook, using race as a wedge. He'd used it on Obama with all the birther libels. He'd even used it against Nikki Haley, deliberately mispronouncing her given name, Nimrata, and pretending he didn't know if she was eligible to be president since her parents were Indian-born. He's an expert at suggesting that someone is a fraud, that you cannot believe this person, which I believe some psychologists would call projection. Hurtful and degrading comments are sadly part and parcel of running for office these days. You can't endure it at this level unless, above all else, you care about the people who you want to represent and the things you will be able to do to make their lives better. If you do care about that, then there's no time to wallow in self-pity or lament the unfairness of it. Not that you don't feel it. Not that it's okay. It is what it is, and it was familiar to me. Where it crosses the line is when opponents go after family members. That same day, anti-Muslim activist, 9/11 conspiracy peddler, and far-right Trump booster Laura Loomer posted on X about an affair Doug had 15 years earlier in his previous marriage with a teacher at his children's school. It was quickly picked up by the Daily Mail and the New York Post. Of course, I knew about this. Doug had told me about it when we were dating. We disclosed it during my vetting for vice president. By marrying me and taking a very public stand at my side, Doug had knowingly put himself in the line of fire. His former wife, Kirsten, had not, and neither had the kids, nor for that matter the teacher who was soon being ambushed by paparazzi in the driveway of her home. I hated what was happening. The kids had to be reminded of this awful period, that their friends would talk about it all over again, that Kirsten would have her privacy invaded, and that all of them would be dragged back into a miserable time. But I was running for president. I told Doug that he would need to deal with it. I could not look away from the job in front of me. He handled it like the mensch that he is, issuing a statement, taking responsibility, and expressing regret. Kirsten, bravely and forthrightly, issued a statement of her own, saying, "Doug and I decided to end our marriage for a variety of reasons many years ago. He is a great father to our kids, continues to be a great friend to me, and I am really proud of the warm and supportive blended family Doug, Kamala, and I have built together." People like Loomer do their dirty work, hoping their target will lash out and say something inappropriate or be personally wounded to distraction. I don't want my family to be hurt. And I think that's true for every honorable human who runs for office. If we were holding on to norms of decency, families should be off limits. Sadly, they are not. The quote-unquote happened-to-turn-black remarks blew up all over the media. Trump's team pulled out an online cooking show where I'd made masala dosa with Mindy Kaling and chatted with her about my maternal grandparents, using it as, quote, proof that I claimed to be Indian. I am proud of my Indian heritage. I was running to be president, not to be an American history professor. It wasn't my duty to school the former president on America's racial history, the one-drop rule, the one-eighth law, and how this history had been and still is weaponized. When my mother came alone to this country from India as a 19-year-old student in 1958, there were still very few South Asians in the United States. She knew that with a black Jamaican-born father, Americans would see us as black children. She raised Maya and me to be proud black women. I could hear my mother's stern voice. Kamala, don't you ever let anyone tell you who you are. You tell them who you are. On the plane that day, when I first heard about Trump's remark, we patched in Brian Fallon from D.C. on a call to strategize a response. Brian wanted me to punch back with a big speech about my racial identity, like the one Obama had given. I was so pissed that I did not hold back. Are you fucking kidding me? I was not about to take Trump's bait. He lies all the time, I told Brian. He throws out outrageous statements to distract from the real issues. Today he wants me to prove my race. What next? He'll say I'm not a woman and I'll need to show my vagina? Brian, on the other end of the phone, fell silent. I imagined the deep crimson of his blush. August 1st, 96 days to the election. Evan Gershkovich and Paul Whelan were on the move. The complex diplomatic effort that spanned six countries and involved the biggest prisoner exchange since the Cold War was forged of international friendships, the tattered relationships that Joe Biden and I had painstakingly mended after Trump had shredded them in his first term. This result was a product of exactly the kind of skilled diplomacy that Trump and Vance, in their deep and willful ignorance, scorned. Evan and Paul were out of prison, along with 14 other political prisoners. With the Russians, there was always the risk of a last-minute hitch, so we waited anxiously until we had news that they were in safe airspace in flight to Turkey. From there, they'd be flown home to America. Joe Biden had the happy task of alerting their next of kin. I called Yulia Navalnaya. I'd met and spent time with her in Munich. Her husband, Alexei, should have been on that plane. She is an immensely strong and courageous person, but I knew this day would be hard. On the call, I said that while we couldn't bring her husband home to her, I promised we would do our utmost to keep his dream of a free Russia alive. Then I left for Fallbrook Church to celebrate the life of my friend, Sheila Jackson Lee. From 1995, she represented the people of Houston in Congress with exceptional tenacity. President Clinton joked that her name was on the shortest list in his White House, the Just Say Yes list, because you knew she was one of the people who would never stop until she got the thing she wanted from you. So you might as well say yes right from the get-go. After the service, at the Houston airport, I was able to speak to the traveling press about the good news that Russia's unlawful detentions and mockery of justice were finally over. We landed at Joint Base Andrews. The plane carrying Evan and Paul was not due to arrive there till almost midnight, so I went home, changed out of my funeral attire, did a couple hours' work, and then headed back to greet them. the president and I spent those few joyful minutes on the tarmac with the families who had waited in anguish for so long. Paul Whelan, who had been incarcerated the longest, was first down the aircraft steps. As I stood by, the president got so involved in the delighted reunion between Paul and his family that he didn't notice Evan stepping off the plane. There was an awkward moment for Evan as he stood uncertainly at the base of the steps alone, a bemused expression on his face. What about me? The minute I noticed, I walked forward, arms outstretched. He broke into a big grin. He was finally home. August 2nd, 95 days to the election. That Friday morning, the VP selection committee received final vetting memos on the three candidates we'd narrowed down as finalists. The committee would be going through the memos to make sure there were no last-minute surprises before we called them in for face-to-face meetings over the weekend. The residence was staked out by the press, and the media chatter was all about when I'd be interviewing. It felt like we were holding a papal conclave in the residence, and the press outside were waiting for the white smoke. Getting those candidates in and out discreetly without exposing them to a barrage was going to take some cloak and dagger shenanigans. I'd need to make the decision by Monday, at the latest, since we'd announced that I'd appear with my chosen running mate Tuesday night in Philadelphia. The announcement location had been picked well in advance, simply because Pennsylvania was the most critical swing state, with 19 electoral votes. Secrecy around the interviews was important. It built excitement and momentum for the campaign. I planned to announce my decision by video, text, and email to supporters just before the Philly rally. The shortlist had been closely held. It was so secret that even my personal schedule identified the finalists only as candidate 1, 2, and 3. But media were reporting that some on the longer list who'd been considered earlier had cleared their schedules, canceling events in case they got the call to meet with me that weekend. Some big egos were about to take a bruising, and these were important people with vital work to do. It was wrong to keep them in the dark. We decided to let CNN know that the three finalists were Mark Kelly, Josh Shapiro, and Tim Walz. Trump, of course, immediately took the most divisive tact he could think of, musing publicly that Josh Shapiro's Jewish identity would cost me the votes of Arab Americans. It was a typical dog whistle, except that now the frequency was audible to more than his Charlottesville tiki torch acolytes. The timing of my running mate announcement had been driven by the virtual roll call of Democratic Convention delegates that had started the night before. I couldn't announce a running mate until I officially held the nomination. There was zero suspense about that, since mine was the only name on the ballot. Because of our superhuman effort on the day Joe dropped out, we'd made it clear that I had the support needed, and no other candidate competed to get the 300 signatures required by party rules to challenge me. The balloting was open till Monday evening, but word came through about 1 p.m. Friday from the party chair reporting that I'd crossed the threshold in the vote tally, making me the nominee. I was pressing on with the business at hand when Sheila grabbed me by the arms and said, "Please, just take 30 seconds. You need to appreciate the historic thing you've just accomplished." Trump had been saying he'd decide about debating me once I clinched the nomination. Sure enough, he released a statement on his Truth Social platform. It was classic Trump. Yes, he would debate me, but he'd reneged on the agreement negotiated for that debate. According to him, it would now be on September 4th, not 10th. It would be on Fox News, not ABC. And, quote, "The rules will be similar to the rules of my debate with Sleepy Joe, who has been treated horribly by his party, but with a full arena audience, unquote. I'm sure his team leaned on him to keep the rule that mics would be silenced during the other debater's time. That was the one rule I wanted changed. I knew I could handle his disruptive asides, and I wanted viewers to see and hear how undisciplined and bullying he could be. His team knew that his crazy ranting didn't play well, so they'd kept that requirement in place. The wording of his statement made it sound as if I'd agreed to all the other changes. Nope. We could sense an air of panic in the Trump campaign. That day, we'd announced that we'd taken in $310 million in the last month alone, more than double his donations over the same period. So we decided to punch back hard. I responded I would be in the ABC studio on September 10th, whether he was there or not, and would be glad to use the 90 minutes of airtime exclusively. August 3rd, 94 days to the election. When we moved into the vice president's residence, I'd worked with a craftsman to design a table for the dining room. It comprised three squares that could fit together as one long table for big dinners or staff meetings, but could also be separated for smaller, more intimate occasions with drop leaves that could be raised to make them round. On Saturday morning, we arranged the room for the next day's interviews. There was just a single square table in the center of the room. I would sit on one side, my potential VP would sit on the other. Either Sheila Nix or J.O.D. would be on the sofa across the room, out of the candidate's line of sight. They would alternate as my second pair of eyes and ears. I didn't want to overstaff what was already a stressful situation. Very few people have ever made this decision. I called Hillary and Bill Clinton because they knew what it was like and would give me candid and confidential advice. One of your strengths, they said, is that you bring a joyful energy to the campaign. You have to choose someone who won't work against that. They told me to be aware that over the course of the campaign, people will be able to tell if it is a genuinely good relationship or a political marriage of convenience. Bill, you have to level with them and watch how they answer. Bill said that Al Gore was good for him because he knew things I didn't know. We were as different as daylight and dark, and it worked, he said. They both emphasized that I'd be offering this person the chance of a lifetime, so they'd better know it. If they were someone dying for immediate public recognition, it might not be the job for them. They might have to swallow a lot of crap. My staff and I spent much of the day going over the briefing books on each finalist, working out what we needed to glean from this final interview. We had the data. The main question remaining was, are they going to be compatible? I'd recruited my invaluable social secretary and residence manager, Storm Horncastle, to collect each finalist in her 1999 Jeep Wrangler. The press was used to seeing her coming and going from the residence, so if her passenger ducked, no one would know he was here. We dubbed it Operation Veep in a Jeep. I had an ulterior motive for recruiting Storm for this job. Storm is from Norway, not especially political, and had mostly worked in embassies prior to taking the job with me at the vice president's residence. She has an exquisitely tuned sense of protocol, is an excellent judge of character, and does not hold back her opinions. I thought it would be telling to see how each finalist treated her. Over the years, I'd learned it's one thing how people treat me. It's another to see how they behave towards someone they perceive as less powerful. I'm especially sensitive to this because as a child, I saw how my mother, a small brown woman with a foreign accent, would be treated in a fancy department store or other public places as if she didn't belong or couldn't afford to be there. She was a distinguished scientist. doing groundbreaking research. But often, I saw her encounter derision and disrespect. I needed to know that my running mate was a person who valued the dignity of everyone and would take a moment to show it. August 4th, 93 days to the election. The pack of reporters staking out the gate to the Naval Observatory that Sunday had no idea that Storm had secretly arranged to come and go through an alternate entrance that hadn't been used for about 20 years. Inside, I would be making one of the most difficult decisions of my life, against a background of international tension. On July 31st, Israel had pulled off the audacious assassination of Hamas's political leader right in the heart of Tehran, at the guest house of the Revolutionary Guard, no less. We expected Iran to respond. The question was how, when, and with what consequences. There's campaigning, and there is governing. That weekend, I would have to divide my focus between my role as a candidate for president and my most solemn duty as sitting vice president to help protect our nation's security. We had decided to hold a pre-brief before each interview and a debrief after. I knew all three men. We'd worked together. But this encounter was going to be very different. Josh Shapiro, governor of Pennsylvania, arrived first. Storm had picked him up from the parking lot of an elementary school in Glover Park. At the last minute, Storm had traded her Jeep for a vehicle with tinted windows, since discretion in this process was so important to us. Josh went to get in the front seat, but Storm instructed that he needed to be in the back so he could duck and not be seen. She thought he seemed a little disappointed by that. When he learned she was the residence manager, he peppered her with questions about the house, from the number of bedrooms to how he might arrange to get Pennsylvania artists' work on loan from the Smithsonian. In our meeting, he was, as always, poised, polished, and personable. I told him how much I admired his work. He was great on the stump, a wonderful campaigner, very compelling and very bright. Our careers synced in many places. While employed as a political advisor on Capitol Hill, he took night classes to get his law degree at Georgetown and then ran for Pennsylvania State House. He had been twice elected state attorney general. I'd had a chance to see how his mind worked when we were both Rodell Fellows at the Aspen Institute in 2006, when he was a member of the Pennsylvania State House and I was San Francisco DA. That two-year bipartisan program for young elected leaders included seminars on the founding documents of democracy and ethics, as well as international trips exploring global issues. Josh had been elected governor in 2022 and was popular in a state with 19 electoral votes that we badly needed to win. We talked about how to handle the attacks he'd confronted on Gaza and what effect it might have on the enthusiasm we were trying to build. Big protests at the convention were a major concern. As a student, he'd written an op-ed stating that peace with Palestinians was impossible, and this decades-old article had been dragged out to smear him as, quote, genocide Josh. He said he'd felt he'd been able to deal with critics by stating clearly that his youthful opinion had been misguided and that he was fully committed to a two-state solution. He had also publicly called Netanyahu, quote, one of the worst leaders of all time. I asked him if he understood the job of vice president. Because if you do, you'll be good at it, and our administration will be strong, I told him. He peppered me with questions, trying to nail down in detail what role I saw for my vice president. At one point, he mused that he would want to be in the room for every decision. I told him bluntly that was an unrealistic expectation. A vice president is not a co-president. I had a nagging concern that he would be unable to settle for a role as number two and that it would wear on our partnership. I had to be able to completely trust the person in that role. Every day as president, I said, I'll have 99 problems and my vice president can't be one. Apart from the apprehensions for myself, I was also concerned for him. I thought his frustrations with the job might impact his performance in the role. And why take an effective Democratic governor out of a job he liked and was good at? But could I afford to turn my back on such a talented political athlete in such a critical state? Josh assured me he'd do everything to help me win Pennsylvania, whether I chose him or not, because this is the most important election we have faced, he said. I had time to hash out these thoughts in a debrief with my team. Meanwhile, Storm returned Josh to the pickup location. Storm instructed the state trooper, who was arranging transport, on an alternate route that would avoid driving by the vice president's residence on Massachusetts Avenue. She assumed that the press would notice official vehicles with Pennsylvania plates. She was disappointed, 10 minutes later, to see those very cars on CNN, cruising right by the residence. That lack of discretion did not play well with her. She picked up Minnesota Governor Tim Walz from a nearby dog park. He was amused by the cloak and dagger shenanigans. On the drive, they talked about her Norwegian background. His state has a large Norwegian community. And when he arrived, he seemed touched that Storm had his preferred beverage, Diet Mountain Dew, on the table, ready for him. It was quickly clear to me that Tim had walked into that room feeling he wouldn't get the job. The first thing he said as he sat down, I don't even know if the door had closed behind him, was, whether or not you pick me, I'm going to do everything I can to get you elected. He was immediately self-critical. I'm not a good debater, he said. I've never used a teleprompter. He was less polished than Josh, but he had an appealing authenticity and was genuinely self-deprecating. A lot of people in politics act self-deprecating, but it's just that, an act. If anything, Tim over-indexed his own liabilities. On the face of it, we had nothing in common. I'm West Coast, he's Midwest. I was born in Oakland and grew up in a working-class urban neighborhood. He's from a rural town of 400 on the Nebraska Plains. I worked at McDonald's in the summer. He worked on his family's farm. Despite those differences, Tim reminded me of everyone I grew up with. He was plain-spoken, hardworking, strong, kind, and a fighter for what he believes is right. And he had a sense of humor. Never mind the teleprompter, here was a guy who knew how to put an engine together, a guy who could talk knowledgeably to a farmer about hogs and soybeans, a guy who knew what it meant to hunt in fall, to put food in the freezer to last through winter. None of it was shtick. It's just who he is. He would make the case for the people who were not in the room. Even more valuable, Tim would notice who was not in the room and would know how to reach them. Of the three candidates, this quality was authentic and unique to him. As a farmer, factory worker, Army National Guardsman, social studies teacher, football coach, and Democrat who had beaten a six-term Republican to win a congressional seat in 2006 and hold it through five elections, Tim had the most diverse life experience. He and his wife, Gwen, had struggled with infertility and had their daughter, Hope, through intrauterine insemination. Their son, Gus, still in high school, had special needs. Tim had the empathy that came from living those experiences. He knew what it meant to suffer as much as he knew what it meant to succeed. His record as a two-term governor was impressive. He'd pushed for and signed legislation codifying reproductive rights, providing free school meals, making college tuition free for low-income families, and requiring universal background checks for gun buyers. Under his leadership, his state was designated one of the most business-friendly in the nation. These were issues that mattered to me. They were the kinds of achievements I wanted for my administration. I felt like Tim knew how to help me get them done. He said he had no ambition to be president, that his aim as vice president would be doing meaningful work to improve people's lives. It's no bad thing for a vice president to want to be president, unless that ambition plays a corrosive role in the relationship and causes disloyalty. That wouldn't be an issue with Tim. He had no fixed ideas about what the role of vice president should be, saying he would do whatever I found was most useful for him to do. Finally, Storm set off to collect Mark Kelly, senator from Arizona. As she drove up to the agreed meeting point, he texted her, "I'm in the Tesla by the dumpsters." For an astronaut who had walked in space, it was a very down-to-earth location for a rendezvous. By the time I sat down with Kelly, Shapiro and Walls had both impressed me in completely different ways. There was very little weight on the scale favoring one over the other. The choice between them was tough enough. Now, an American hero had entered the room, a Navy baseball cap paired handsomely with his business suit. Kelly served 24 years in the United States Navy, retiring as a highly decorated captain with over 5,000 flying